Good morning. Modern times keep redefining personal space and privacy. A bill up for hearing today would prohibit employers from accessing an employee's personal accounts. Representative Matt Lopresti joins us later this hour. And driver's education often makes parents nervous, so what if it included education about organ and tissue donation? We'll get some insight from Carol McNamee of Mothers Against Drunk Driving. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. We'll be talking to musicians with a mission this morning. Taimane is preparing a Hawaii theater show that combines music with dance, multimedia, and theater. She'll be with us live in our studio. And for Babatunji Heath and his band, the mission is to get everybody off on the good foot.
It's Friday, January 29th. That's The Conversation, and it starts right after this news. Good morning and welcome to an Aloha Friday, easing into the day a little
That's bit
right. As we got a weekend ahead of us. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
And you are Chris Vandercook.
That's right, I am.
I'm looking at you. I've got the guitar behind you, and you've got an amplifier. Nice, cute little thing sitting there in front of you. That means we're going to have some music today, doesn't it?
We're going to deploy a little music a little bit later on, yeah.
All right. Well, first we're going to have a conversation or two, starting with this one. Now, if you're a parent, you know that it can be tough enough to see your child behind the wheel for the very first time. It's a rite of passage into adulthood, yet often includes errors in judgment that can continue into later years. That includes driving while impaired. According to the Centers for Disease Control, among drivers with blood alcohol levels of 0.08% or higher involved in fatal crashes, one out of every three were between the ages of 21 and 24. A bill scheduled for hearing today would add another component of reality to driver's education, information about organ and tissue donation. We called Carol McNamee, the founder of the Hawaii chapter of Mothers Against Drunk Driving, to get her take, and she's on the line with us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
We've often talked about trying to make kids understand consequences and understanding where they are in their own development, their own brain development. Is there something that makes it a little bit more real to them when you talk about having organ or tissue donation being part of their driver's education?
Well, I think that there is a very good chance that that would happen because, as we know, young people tend to think that they are immortal, that nothing can harm them. Of course, especially the males are great risk takers, and sometimes this is a good thing. But sometimes, especially when we're talking about using a vehicle and they don't have a lot of experience with that anyway, it becomes a real problem. So I am thinking that once you start talking about donating your organs from your body, should you be in a crash that ends up to be a fatal crash, this might get their attention. They might be a little more interested in listening up. So I think it is a very unusual and inventive idea.
We've seen campaigns, media campaigns about drunk driving and those involving teens. Certainly we've seen far too many headlines about teens who have lost their lives or young people who have lost their lives because of driving while impaired. At the younger ages, when you're talking about someone who is 14, 15, 16, to be learning about organ donation or tissue donation, from your experience in dealing with young people, is that something that might be a vehicle for them to understand that death really is or a possible consequence of driving?
Well, you know, I think it will be hard to know that for sure, Beth Ann, and until we get some results, if this does become become a law. Of course, I don't know what might be happening right now in the driver's ed program. I know I spoke to someone who has a granddaughter in Washington, D.C., and they said, oh, yes, that is part of their curriculum already, that I don't know how much, but they do talk about becoming an organ donor. And this young girl, who I believe was about 14, 15, did sign up for it, you know, no problem. It didn't seem to bother her, but she may be, you know, a responsible type anyway. But the ones who, as I said, are thinking that nothing can harm them, I would think if they learned about organ donation and then had a piece of paper in front of them where they actually had to write down that they agreed to be an organ donor, that's going to be a step, I think, that might break through that denial that anything could happen to them. Really signing on the line, I think might do it. But again, it's very hard to know until we get some results back. I haven't seen this happen, or I haven't read about this happening in other places, so I personally don't have any data. And I don't know who introduced this bill and whether they got the idea, this person got the idea from some other state or community. That would be interesting to know if they have gotten this idea from someplace where it was successful. And again, you know, things like this are also hard to measure. There's a lot of different variables in what's happening in the life of a teenager. But if there were some way to measure it, it would be very, very interesting.
For parents, is there a downside, you know, to this? We were talking about kids who are minors who might just say, oh, sure, I'll sign it, and not necessarily even have that conversation with parents?
Well, as I read the bill, it really does try to involve the parents, and actually the parents can decide if they wish to opt out, have their student opt out of this. But otherwise, I believe that they know it's happening and actually get a chance to look at the materials. And I think you bring up a very good point, though, Beth Ann, is that recently Matt has had a program called The Power of Parents. And the whole premise of that program is that parents need to take the time and find the opportunities to talk to their young teens, especially just before they get a driver's license, all about alcohol, and don't shy away from the subject. It's really important to have conversations. And I think that this is another thing that this bill would do, or this program anyway would do, is that they'll be forced to say, oh, organ donation, let me sign you up for that. And then from there, they might go into all the problems of what could befall them if they drink and they drive as they go into getting their first driver's license and learning to become a responsible driver, we hope.
All right, we're going to leave it there for the moment and see how this bill moves along. But thanks very much, Carol, for your insight on it, as you've been so involved with MAD for 32 years and trying to keep more people alive and driving sober. Thanks so much.
You're so welcome. And actually, we have made progress. So that's the good thing to remember. And I hope maybe this will take us to another step.
Thanks very much. Carol McNamee founded the Hawaii chapters of MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, in 1984 and has since served on the national board of MAD. HB 1775, the bill to add information about organ and tissue donation to driver's education, is scheduled to be heard this morning.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's 8:13. Coming up, a new career milestone in the offing for Taimane. First, your backyard quiz.
Modern access to information about history may be as close as your smartphone, but in today's backyard quiz, we're going back to the beginning of Hawaiian newspapers. They've played an important role in Hawaiian history ever since the American Board of Foreign Missions sent over Hawaii's first printing press in 1820, which you can still see at the Mission Houses Museum near downtown Honolulu. The missionaries on the island used the printing press to promote literacy and give the spoken Hawaiian language a written form. Several small newspapers printed in Hawaiian began to pop up. The first one appeared in 1834, but it was produced by American missionaries and often was used to spread Christianity. 27 years later, another first appeared on the Hawaiian journalism scene, the first Hawaiian language newspaper established by a native Hawaiian. So for today's quiz, what was the name of this first Hawaiian paper produced entirely by native Hawaiians? Call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right gets a pair of tickets to Taimani's Hawaii Theater debut.
Good morning. I'm Jennifer Rose from the University of Hawaii at Manoa. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Taimane is a young ukulele virtuoso who's always looked for ways to incorporate her music into a broader message. For that, you need a stage and a setting that can accommodate big ideas. In a couple of months, she'll be incorporating some of those ideas into a musical and theatrical odyssey called The Elements. It's her Hawaii theater debut, and she's in our studio to share some music and tell us about this latest step forward in her evolution. Good morning, Taimane.
Good morning, Chris.
That little excerpt we just heard, you've already played enough notes for one day, haven't you?
Probably for a couple days, really.
Yeah.
That one was Mercury, messenger of the gods, so it kind of makes sense that he's pretty quick.
He's fleet of foot, right?
Exactly.
Well, it's always been part of your music, trying to really tell a story with it and make it more than just some notes, yeah?
Definitely. Well, as you know, I've always been interested in the planets, but I'm really excited for this next show. We're kind of going from the planets into the elements.
Uh-huh.
And so there's going to be a song for each element, and I'm doing five elements. I'm not going to say what is the fifth element.
Okay.
But I'm quite excited. Of course, I have to make it super theatrical and have a bunch of dancers and a bunch of different elements in it.
Right.
So I'm really excited for it.
Well, you're doing choreography in addition to the music, is that right?
Somewhat, yeah. Just blocking here and there, but I'm having some dancers come in and do most of the choreography, and I would just sit there and just say, I really like that, or, I guess it's more of producing a show.
Mm-hmm.
I love, being the boss and seeing this vision come to life, and so having it be at Hawaii Theater is going to be a huge step for me personally and for my career.
Well, it's part of any venue is filling the room with your music, right?
Mm-hmm.
And accommodating, sort of making, you almost make the room a part of your instrument if it's a really good sounding room. Right?
Definitely. The ambience, but also the energy from the audience is very important for us musicians, because we have this, you know, symbiotic relationship of sharing energy. And so, you know, when you have an audience there who's really into what you're doing, it really electrifies the place.
Yeah. Have you had, did you have the experience earlier in your career when the audience was not
definitely
giving you much help?
I still do, you know. I would say it's actually a little harder to impress people nowadays, because you see amazing things every day on your phone. But
yeah,
you just accept it. You can call it paid practice. But it's a good ego lesson for you to not take things personally. Which I think is good.
And also maybe that a good response from an audience is not something that happens automatically, right?
Exactly. And I've learned that if you play something soft, you're not going to get the same reaction for if you play something really fast. And
yeah,
it doesn't mean that they're not enjoying it. It's just more of maybe an internal appreciation for something soft that you've played.
Yeah. And you know, if you play a slow tune, maybe you have to set up the audience to be patient enough to sit through it, right? We give them some fast tunes, and then the slow tune comes as a relief. That's all part of it.
Exactly. One of my albums, Ukulele Dance, was great, but it was also quite exhausting to listen to, just because it was like crazy ukulele music.
Everything's
for
up-tempo. Yeah.
Exactly. And so my most recent album, We Are Made of Stars, I've kind of learned that the slow songs, like you said, are a relief for the brain to kind of take in what just happened.
Yeah, yeah. And if you sort of, it takes a certain state of mind to really enjoy a ballad, but when you're in the right state of mind for a slow tune, it can be terrific.
Exactly. Especially if there's a story to it. That's why I like to add little stories to my songs and then explain it so people can get on the same wavelength as you and enjoy the ride.
Well, here's something that isn't a song yet, but when Taimani came in this morning, I showed her some chord changes and said, what would you play to this? So this is kind of a song that is not yet born, right? Let's just see what comes up.
It's called Jamming at 8:20 a.m.
Okay, good. See, it had everything but a title before.
Thank you.
Hey, that was fun, Taimani. Thanks for that.
No worries. It's definitely a different playing a song in the morning.
Well, what I like about that and the reason I wanted to do that was that I've always thought you had a real sense of adventure in your music. Fair to say?
Oh, definitely. I'm sure you can notice with my prancing and staring people down when I play music.
Yes. Well, don't ever stop, Taimani. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me, Chris and Bethann. It's great to be in the conversation.
Taimani will perform a musical and theatrical odyssey, The Elements, on Friday, March 25th. It's her Hawaii Theater debut. You can learn more about it on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Would you date someone from a different political party? I'm Ira Flatow. On the next Science Friday, we look at how political bias is influencing more than how you vote. Plus, wind chill is getting a cool reevaluation. Now, how do octopuses use crazy signals to communicate? All on Science Friday from PRI.
This morning from 9 to 11, right after the conversation.
Once upon a time, there was a radio station that told important stories and told them well. Thank you to these station members who believe in Hawaii Public Radio and the stories that we tell. Roberta Melton of Honolulu, Michael Hu of Kailua, and Sarah Hamakawa of Honolulu. If you'd also like HPR to live happily ever after, your membership dollars will help. Reach us at 955-8821 during business hours or at hawaiipublicradio.org. And thanks.
Support for The Conversation comes from Bank of Hawaii Private Banking, where a personal relationship manager and financial services team provide custom solutions. Learn more about Bank of Hawaii Private Banking at boh.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Even after the experience with dengue, Hawaii is ill-equipped to deal with an outbreak of the Zika virus. That's the word from the Centers for Disease Control. And although an outbreak might be unlikely, the Hawaii Department of Health is looking for ways to boost its response. Civil Beat's Chad Blair has today's reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethann.
It seems that you can't turn on a news report without hearing something about Zika, and rightly so, because it has some dangerous implications. But for Hawaii, given the fact that we've just had this episode with dengue, which isn't over yet, how is that fitting into what we might be able to do if there really were a Zika outbreak?
Well, this is coming from a CDC official who just last month was evaluating how the state was doing on the dengue outbreak. And by the way, generally good marks for the DOH's response and for others, although there is some criticism from some folks on the Big Island that not enough has been done or in preparation for a possible greater outbreak. But specific to Zika, this official is saying that there's been a lot of layoffs, a lot of cutbacks at the Department of Health, and specifically the state today employs half as many vector control workers as it did just 7 years ago. This is due to budget cuts. As well, this DOH only has a limited number of entomologists, and of course those are the scientists who study insects. And there's also a concern about communication. There is only one communications personnel at the DOH compared to five just a few years ago. So with all these cutbacks, the fear is, should Zika happen here? And you're right, it's unlikely that it could happen. But with dengue, it's given us some extra caution. The concern is that the DOH will not be able to respond should a crisis emerge.
And there are some issues with Zika that weren't necessarily present with dengue, also the issue of maybe chikungunya, other diseases that don't usually, you know, come into our conversation, but have because of what we've seen happen in other countries, especially in Brazil. Earlier this morning, there was the NPR report, and, you know, the idea is that you know, look, somebody goes someplace else, gets bitten by a mosquito, gets sick, comes here, another mosquito here bites it, and then you've got a potential problem. So if we have so little folks ready to, you know, spring into action should that happen, what is the Hawaii Department of Health saying in terms of creating more? Is there actually more money to shore up the Hawaii Department of Health?
Our reporter, Jessica Terrell, said the DOH is trying to get at least temporary funding for some of those positions. There are some bills at the legislature concerning vector control and responding to an outbreak. She did talk to Richard Cregan, who's a medical doctor on the Big Island as well as a state representative, and he said, you know, if Zika happened here, you would kill tourism for 1 to 2 years. And think about it, where Zika has happened has been in warm tropical places, Brazil, Puerto Rico, Samoa, the Virgin Islands. In El Salvador, they're actually saying women should not get pregnant until 2018. So I don't want to raise too much alarm here, but the idea that the state is perhaps not prepared should a crisis develop, that is the big concern. And I think it'll be a topic that lawmakers will be addressing this session.
And that we will no doubt be talking about. Thanks very much,
yes.
Chad. Have a good weekend, and we'll
you
be
too.
Back at it on Monday with another Reality
oh
Check.
Thanks, Bethann.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat, and Daly joins us for a Reality Check.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Noheya Gallery and Kaiser Permanente.
Friday's news always comes with a look at the coming week, and to do that, HPR's news director Bill Dorman joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethann.
Well, here we are. We had some good fun this week as we sat down and listened to what the governor has to say and what the legislature may do with what he has to say and what his wish list is, and lots of good wishes going into this week, but now we're going to hit prime time with the ledge. And a lot of hearings scheduled.
Exactly. And now, you know, again, as you mentioned, the season of the opening of the legislature, then the state of the state. And that was interesting to watch that together as the governor went through that. And now into hearings, and now into more than 2,000 pieces of legislation out there. And of course, not everyone is going to get full examination, but there are, as you say, a lot of hearings, a lot of conversations going on. And one of the, if not themes, the common issues, certainly that we know will continue to evolve during the session is homelessness and the various parts of that situation and the various policy prescriptions that are being looked at to deal with them. So, for example, next week the House Human Services Committee takes up a number of measures appropriating money in this direction, including outreach efforts, some transitional services, other aspects, and they're going to start to discuss again the return to home pilot program. The one to get stranded homeless folks here who have a place to go back on the mainland to help them along their way.
This is the one that was started or piloted by IHS?
Yes. And sort of how that goes through, what they're, again, on forward-looking now, what do we do? Areas moving beyond pilot programs and to looking to expand some things. A lot to keep track of. As you know, Wayne Yoshioka, our guy at the Ledge, he'll be our guide next week in updating us, not just with that series, but with a number of things that are going on as well.
So moving off Oahu for a moment, let's take a look at what's happening on Kauai visitor-wise.
Yeah, so one of the most popular visitor spots in the state, ranked as one of the top 10 national wildlife refuges in the country, the Kilauea Point National Wildlife Refuge, draws about 250,000 visitors
wow,
every year. I didn't realize it
people.
Was that high. Right now it's closed. because it's undergoing some changes. But we see the role that erosion is playing around the state. That's certainly coming in spades at this site. Scott Jarman up on Kauai is taking a look at this, will let us know what they're looking at, where this goes, and how long it takes, and give us a bit of an outlook on that as well.
And speaking of outlooks, we're going to get a check-in with the Hokulea.
Yeah, you know, another landmark. They have more than a month since they left Cape Town, South Africa on Christmas Eve, actually, and now heading to Brazil. This week arrived at an island off Brazil and a couple hundred miles off the coast of the mainland of Brazil. Molly Solomon is going to give us a full update on where they are and what their outlook is.
Some very good things to look forward to next week.
You bet.
Thanks so much.
All right.
Bill Dorman is HPR's news director. On a Friday, we also read your letters and emails. We got this after Monday's reality check about school community councils.
Aloha, Beth Ann. In our Seattle school, we worked very hard to bring parents into the school. Teaching to me was always like a three-legged stool, parents, students, and teachers. Hispanic students were very present in our low-income school. In Mexico, it was explained to us, parents never entered the school because that was the domain of la maestro, the teacher. We had a fabulous parent involvement coordinator. She set up regular brunches for the moms of the students. Many adults were initially afraid to become involved because of immigration issues, but all were welcomed with open arms. Respectfully, Edwina Spiegel.
And this came in after our conversation with Representative Cynthia Thielen. I wonder if a Democrat had introduced the legislation concerning hemp, if it would have gained more traction. So frustrating that the two parties can't seem to get along on anything. I'm a Democrat and completely support Cynthia Thielen's advocacy on hemp. I would love to see miles of hemp instead of concrete on Oahu and Maui. Aloha, Michelle Grotstein, Kaneohe.
And finally, we got this on our talkback line.
Good morning. This is Carla Sachi. Just wanted to leave a comment. The man that was speaking said, oh, I'm not worried about where my food is coming from, as if we were talking about financial status. And I want to just mention, I live on coconut milk from my coconut trees, sweet potatoes from my garden, avocados, mangoes, lemons, limes, bananas. I could just go on and on. My own chocolate that I ferment and make myself. And people who own property, if they don't have fruit trees, ought to be spanked because there is no excuse for not having a lemon tree in your yard when they charge a half a dollar for a lemon. That is my comment. Thank you.
Thanks for the letters and calls. Our talkback line is 808-792-8217. Or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
The concept of privacy continues to morph as personal devices cross over into the workspace and employees often access personal accounts at work. Expectations of privacy may also be changing. Still, there's the belief that what's private is private and shouldn't be compelled to be shared with an employer. Later this morning, the State House Labor Committee will consider a bill to shore up the information guarding access to employees' personal accounts. Representative Matt Lopresti introduced the measure, and he's on the line now. Good morning.
Good morning.
This idea of privacy that we keep talking about because it keeps changing, it's also been frustrated a little bit by what we talked about a month or so ago with some changing ideas concerning personal devices, things that people may use for work that they in fact own or maybe will go in on with an employer. Doesn't that make it kind of fuzzy to see really what's private and what's personal and what's rather what should be public?
I certainly understand that there's growing confusion as much as concern for privacy when it comes to digital your social media or your emails and your devices. But I think the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution of the United States is pretty clear about us having rights to privacy. And when the Founding Fathers wrote the Constitution, they obviously didn't have Facebook or texting or emails. They had papers. And what they were talking about is having privacy for their papers and their personal correspondences. And that's how I view much of what happens on social media and certainly what happens on emails. So I think that we need to make sure that we extend our digital civil rights or our digital civil liberties we should extend their civil liberties into the digital age.
The flip side of that, given the fact that, you know, we all know that we take devices into work and we use them to access work email, all of that, should that also mean that in addition to safeguarding someone's privacy, that we also need to have maybe mandated policies in businesses about what it means to use devices that one personally owns?
Yes, I think that is called for. And what this bill does, while it prevents employers from requiring or requesting or coercing employees or potential employees from getting access to their personal accounts, it does not prohibit the employer from having access to their own equipment or to things that are relevant to the business that they're conducting. So I think there's a we have to make sure that we allow for businesses to maintain access to business-related information, of course, but at the same time, I think we have to protect people's rights to privacy.
When we spoke with attorney Stephanie Thompson last month, and she was cautioning about changing rules regarding access from an employer to an employee's tablet or smartphone if it were also being used to access email, business email, she said that, you know, most people don't realize that this could be something that could be taken over by an employer, something that might have use for a case and might be, you know, compelled to be released. That seems to also create a situation where privacy and the personal life is so integrated that creating something like this, saying that, you know, employers can't have access or employers might need to have access, would be frustrating each other. How do you get some better clarity in all of this when we seem to be changing how we're behaving on a day-to-day basis?
That's a fair question. There's always going to be, with new legislation, I think, some areas that of contention that might be uncertain. But there are, I think, certain very clear areas where there's grievous invasions of privacy where it's not illegal right now. I mean, to me, it's kind of a creepy factor. Would it be creepy to have your employer trolling you on Facebook? Yes, I think it would be, and I don't think they have any right to be doing that. It has nothing whatsoever to do with your work with them. Would it be creepy and a grievous invasion of privacy for them to be snooping in your email, even though you might have checked it on that computer? They have no right to get in there if it's, you know, you're on your lunch break and you're emailing your sweetheart. It's not their business. So we have to start drawing the line somewhere to protect that privacy, and that starts a conversation about where those lines should be drawn, and that's part of what this bill does.
Do you think then that this is really meant to be the conversation starter as opposed to expecting that this is going to move all the way through this legislative session?
Well, I do expect it to move all the way through because an earlier iteration of this did make it all the way to conference. There was not a single no vote, either Republican or Democrat, in the entire House or in the entire Senate. I don't think it's very controversial as a bill. But we do have to be careful to make sure that businesses still have access to business-related data, and I don't think this bill prohibits them from doing that. We had testimony last time from Americans for Democratic Action, School Kids, College Kids, Civil Rights Commission, ACLU, and none of the testimony that I saw had any deep, legitimate concerns about businesses not having access to business-related material.
Or for people who understand that their devices may very well not necessarily be solely theirs if they're also using it for business purposes. I mean, I know we keep talking about this a lot because this was very upsetting to people when they heard this and we talked to them last month, and the idea of what's really private and what's really accessible to your employer is growing so fuzzy in so many ways. So if this protects an employee's privacy, is there also something that you think that needs to be written for employers when there is a BYOD, you bring your own device policy, or not even a policy, but just a de facto policy, because people are saying, sure, I'll buy my own, or here I can, I'm going to have it come stream through my tablet or my smartphone.
That's interesting. I sadly have to admit I missed that conversation that day. I'm a member and a listener, regular, but I missed the conversation you guys had about devices. So I can't say that I've given much consideration to that, and that's something I'll have to think more about.
Well, if you missed it, I will tell you it's on the archive, and for anyone else who wants to hear it too, it's back about a month or so. Anyway, thank you very much for joining us. We'll continue to take a look at all of these things, and we'll talk to you shortly, I'm sure.
Thank you, Bethany.
Representative Matt Lopresti is the Hawaii State Representative for District 41.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Straub Clinic and Hospital and Gourmet Events Hawaii.
Earlier in today's show, we asked you for the name of the first newspaper created entirely by Native Hawaiians. Although newspapers have been printing in the island since 1834, most of them were produced by American missionaries with a religious agenda. Among its editors and supporters was a notable member of Hawaiian royalty, Chief and later King David Kalakaua. A prominent, well-liked member of the newsroom, Kalakaua soon received the nickname Editor King. Kahoku influenced several newspapers to come and covered a wide range of topics, ranging from the decline of Native Hawaiian populations to issues of Hawaiian land use, issues current publications continue to tackle today. It wasn't until 1861 that the Kahoku o Ka Paki Pika, our Star of the Pacific, was born. And nobody got that one today. Kind of a shame.
I guess we'll be keeping our Taimani tickets.
I guess we have to hang on to them for the next one, right?
We'll try again on Monday.
We will. And at 8:48, that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to Talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, host of the annual Literacy Leadership Conference, February 1st through 4th, introducing the Leadership Institute track for school and complex area administrators. Registration closes January 31st.
The name of the band, Goodfoot, should tell you all you need to know about its music. This is a band that sets out to get you on the dance floor and keep you there. That's not always easy, but if you combine the best of soul, funk, and Afrobeat, you've got the ingredients for a winning formula. Babatunji Heath keeps the beat behind his drum kit for Goodfoot, and he's with us this morning. Good morning, Tunji. Thanks
Good morning,
for coming
Chris.
In.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
What made you folks want to get this band going?
Well, like you said, really, I started this band with Jason Forrester, who's the bass player. Mm-hmm. So you imagine we're starting with bass and drums.
It's building up from the foundation.
We're working the foundation, and we really wanted to be playing music that people would be moving to. We love playing for people dancing.
Yeah.
And I just have a sort of, personally, I have a passion for all those types of music, funk, soul, and Afrobeat. I love all kinds of music, but those particularly had resonated with me for as long as I can remember. And so we decided we were doing something else, and we wanted to start this, and we were fortunate enough to hook up with a guy named Roland Wakely, who played saxophone, tenor, and guitar. And that opened up the door for us, because we knew we wanted horns.
Yeah.
And I told Jason in the beginning, I think we need about 8 or 9 people. And he thought I was crazy. But I said, we're not doing it for the money. We're doing it to make some music, you know. To make this kind of music, we need enough people.
And that's probably just as well that you're not doing it for the money, because when you play in a club and divide the money 9 ways, you're lucky to get gas home, right?
Yes, it often is the case. And when you start a project like this, which has been a wonderful thing, it's been actually almost 3 years. Uh-huh. We just got together talking about it with our fourth member was Captain Ray Beatty, who plays baritone sax, and that was another key element we felt we wanted to have.
Yeah, very much.
And to sort of anchor the horn section idea. Mm-hmm. And the people that started working with us were willing to do it for the music and put in time and come in and practice and develop the material. And we do original music and we do a lot of covers and we're pulling from different places. And we went out and started doing it and immediately found people really, really liked it, really enjoyed it. So I say we weren't doing it for money, but here we are 3 years later and people are hiring us to play
New
Year's
Eve
parties, real gigs, and we have money in the bank, so we can do more. We can pay musicians that aren't able to be part of our band, and it's been wonderful. It's been wonderful.
We heard a little. That was a little sample of you guys, I think, that we heard going in.
Yeah, know? That was a tune we called "Never Gonna Happen."
Well, and you know, it's in the ways of a funk band. You have this thing of a lot of separate elements that connect in just the right way, but they're not, everybody's not all playing the same thing, duplicating the other person's part. You kind of have guitar doing one thing, bass playing off it, and the drums kind of knit that all together. That's tricky to put together, isn't it?
It is tricky, and it's tricky to sort of bring that to into a place musically where people aren't as familiar with it. I mean, one of the key elements for us in Goodfoot is percussion.
Sure.
And Lori Kimata, who plays percussion, comes from 25 years of playing in sort of West African drum groups. She's part of a group called Jamarek,
uh-huh.
And she'd spent time gone to West Africa and played as well. So she's tuned into the idea of the polyrhythmic approach.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just key to that kind of drumming. And
sure
that's
is.
Key to the element in Afrobeat. Afrobeat was all about, in my interpretation, it was all about that sort of exchange of West African drumming culture, West African music, funk, American funk and soul, mm-hmm. and jazz. I mean, Fela Kuti brought those things together, and that's why I strive to have that. It's part of what we're doing, but we don't. That's not all we do. As we find that a lot of the audience here in Hawaii is pretty new to people. But in the last, I noticed when I came back from Hong Kong that DJs here were playing a lot more Afrobeat, you know, K2H, and here on the jazz shows and the Bridging the Gap, you get Nick Yee's going to be playing Afrobeat on a regular basis, and so it's opened people's ears and dance floors.
Well, Afrobeat and things like James Brown funk, mm-hmm. really complete a continuum. They go full circle. I mean, I remember in the 70s, some musician friends of mine toured Africa, and they said everywhere they went, James Brown.
Absolutely.
James Brown.
Huge. Yeah, yeah. They were all huge. And they took it and they did it in their spirit. And there's no question. I mean, James Brown, he was putting the polyrhythmic element
That's
into
African
funk.
Music,
yeah.
if anything is, really. Yeah. Because it's that you generate one rhythm and then somebody else puts something on top of it that sort of intersects at key points, but isn't necessarily, it's not a duplicate. It's like a... It builds and builds and builds, and you can get any number of layers sometimes.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, I felt like I needed eight people, mm-hmm. you know, eight players to do that, and eight players that were willing to sort of to find those place. And it doesn't get too cluttered or too much as long as people actually find their space.
Yeah,
and that song we just heard, "Never Gonna Happen," was. Kind of never going to happen because it took us so long to get that song to work.
So that's,
you know, because it was one of the ones that really challenged the rhythmic elements, the different polyrhythmic elements happening all at the same time. And people took us a while to feel it.
The trick with polyrhythmic music is you play your part, and no matter what happens, don't deviate, right? Don't get confused by all the other stuff going on around you.
You have to you learn to lock into other people's patterns, but you don't lock in the same place you would on a straight rock and roll tune or a blues
right.
tune, and it's a different feel. But it's you got to hang on to your part, and jazz has that. I mean, I feel the jazz has that element melodically,
absolutely,
as well.
Yeah,
and of course, great jazz is both those things.
Well, good luck with your band, Tunji, and thanks for coming in. It's great to talk to you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Baba Tunji Heath is the drummer for Goodfoot, an 8-piece kaka'ako-based soul, funk, and Afrobeat dance band. It'll perform Tuesday, February 9th, as part of the Mardi Gras Pub Crawl in downtown Honolulu. And you can find out more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
This week on Bridging the Gap, a return to eclectic music programming. We'll hear selections from Las Cafeteras as they wrap up their tour of the islands, as well as a little soul, a little jazz, and the rest of the kitchen sink. I'm Mr. Nick. Join me this Saturday from 6 to 8 p.m. for Bridging the Gap, here on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
But then when the advantages of the internet came along, the World Wide Web and all the revolution in communication that it brought about, not a lot of us gave a lot of thought back then to privacy. That I don't think many people foresaw the degree to which privacy would become an issue in the whole thing of wireless internet communication.
But we sure do now.
We sure do now, yeah.
I mean, not just the convenience of it, of being able sort of, you know, to carry an encyclopedia of the world and
right,
so many
right.
other issues and articles and anything else you might want to access just sort of on your hip. But the idea that once you start to cross lines and use these things in your workplace, and if you're also having a BYOD formal policy in your workplace, that maybe that puts you ahead of other places that does not. All of these questions are swimming around as one of the bills that we're going to be looked at a little later today is going to consider privacy and what employers can't have access to when it comes to your personal accounts. But there are all these other fuzzy areas that don't make it at all clear cut. We'll continue to follow that one. This week is over, but we're going to come back to be with you on a Monday. Meanwhile, in case you're wondering, we're going to talk about this issue. Should a child be required to receive at least one dosage of the human papillomavirus vaccine before grade 7? We're going to hear what Dr. Lee Buenconsejo Lum has to say about that.
And we'll go to a celebration of Keiki Hula on Kauai.
You can call us on our talkback line to leave your comments at 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Our archive is on the hpr2.org website, and our executive producer for the show is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Taylor Rice is our production assistant, and Caitlin Ikuma is our research assistant.
The Backyard Quiz theme is by John DeMello, and I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you Monday. Meanwhile, have a great weekend.